Thursday, July 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, Greece struggles with its economy as its citizens prepare to vote. The United States and Cuba move to restore formal diplomatic relations.
His popularity rate has dropped down to below 30. He's being resented even by the pro-Beijing camps in Hong Kong.
The pro-democracy debate continues in Hong Kong. Also ahead, the United States is about to have a birthday party. We celebrate with music. It's all on today's International Edition. Debt-ridden Greece offered concessions Wednesday on its creditors' demands for more austerity measures. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, though, still urged his nation to vote no in a referendum Sunday on the lenders' plans for new restrictions in exchange for more bailout loans. European leaders contend that a Greek vote against the lenders' plan would amount to Athens withdrawing from the 19-nation euro currency bloc. VOA's Ken Bredemeyer has been closely following the developments. Ken, what's the latest?
Today, as it turns out, was somewhat pivotal in that the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, offered some concessions to the creditors, but it wasn't enough to get anybody to come back to the negotiating table. And then later in the day, he made a national television speech in which he urged his fellow Greeks to vote no on Sunday in the referendum on whether the country ought to accept more austerity in exchange for more bailout loans. As a result, it seems that we might be at somewhat of a standoff here for several more days with no new negotiations. The finance ministers met later Wednesday evening, and they decided it was no time to hold more talks. Let's wait and see what happens in the referendum, is essentially what they said.
Of course, Greece is trying to put forth some new plans, but they seem to be getting a lukewarm reception.
Very lukewarm. I would say that would be charitable to say that. It's more hostile than anything. Much of Europe seems to be fed up with this continuing drama with no end in sight, although the referendum is certainly going to be a key factor. I should note that European leaders say and have told Greece that a no vote is tantamount to leaving the Eurozone, the 19-country euro currency bloc, whereas the prime minister looks at the no vote, at least that's what he told his people Wednesday night. He called it a decisive step for a better agreement. And he says that Greece would aim to sign straight after the referendum a new deal. Now, whether that's possible or not, or whether there even will be a no vote, is unknown at this point. A yes vote, which is to say a vote against Tsipras's wishes, would probably result in a new government in Athens. It would be hard to imagine that the Syriza party would be able to hang on to power if the people of Greece don't want to accept his stance anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's much at stake on Sunday for sure.
Be very interesting to see how the people decide on this one, because the choices are quite large. If you're looking at leaving the Eurozone and going for a new government, wow, that's an interesting choice, I guess, depending how you are doing at the moment.
That's certainly a major decision for the voters. Probably most Greeks would say they want to be part of Europe. They consider themselves part of Europe, and part of Europe, at least for most countries outside of England and Switzerland, a couple other countries. There are 19 countries in the Eurozone. So Greece has an identity there, which would be dumped with unknown results were the Greeks to depart from the Eurozone.
Ken Bredemeyer, thank you very much. Meanwhile, a British online activist recently started a campaign to save Greece from an economic disaster. And what began as something of a joke is now being taken a little bit more seriously. Our social media guru is Michael Lippin. He's here to tell us more. Michael?
Hey, Jim. Yes, believe it. A few days ago, 29-year-old Tom Feeney, who works in a London shoe shop, came up with a seemingly crazy idea to provide an alternative source of rescue money for the Greek government. Not another EU or IMF loan, but a crowdfunding campaign on the Indiegogo website. Now, a crowdfunding campaign, for those unfamiliar, is a way of getting your friends, family, and just about anyone else to raise money for a cause through online donations. The campaign organizer sets an overall donation target and typically offers rewards or gifts for people who pledge certain amounts of money to help reach that target. But the key thing is, if the target is not reached within a certain time frame, all the pledged money is refunded. So Feeney, he decided to launch a campaign on Indiegogo called Greek Bailout Fund with the aim of raising 1.6 billion euros for Greece by July 7th, and he's got six more days to do it.
Wow. Well, that perhaps sounds realistic or not. What kind of response has he actually had?
Well, here's the interesting part. As of a short time ago, I just checked the site, the campaign had actually raised 1.2 million euros from about 70,000 donors. And the campaign is also getting noticed on Twitter, with supporters using hashtags like Greek Bailout Fund and Crowdfund Greece to promote it. And as for what donors can expect in return for their pledges, a mere 3 euros will get you a postcard of Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras sent from Greece. 6 euros will get you a Greek feta and olive salad delivered fresh to your door. And 10 euros gets you a bottle of ouzo. That's a popular Greek alcoholic beverage. Now, the website does say that you'll still have to pay for shipping. Well, there's always a catch, right? And it's not really clear how Feeney and his supporters will actually get all those products shipped in the first place. But, you know, they may not actually have to do anything, because the 1.2 million euros currently pledged have not yet reached even 1% of the target. But who knows?
Interesting. Interesting, Michael. Well, at least we don't have to send in any euros to get your insight. Thanks so much for stopping
not
by.
Not this time. Thanks.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Welcome back to International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama said Wednesday the United States and Cuba have agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations and plan to reopen embassies in Washington and Havana later this month. It's the latest move to end years of hostility between the two countries. Before covering the U.S. Senate, VOA's Michael Bowman spent 5 years in Miami following the LATAM region. That included events in Cuba. He joins us in the studio. Michael, many people in the United States might be expecting this will perhaps lead to access of much-desired Cuban cigars.
Cuban cigars, Cuban rum, all number of things that are produced in the tropics. The answer is perhaps one day, but not just yet. This was an important diplomatic step in terms of announcing that embassies would be reopening and a full restoration of diplomatic ties that had been severed more than 50 years ago. But the U.S. trade embargo of Cuba remains. And for that to be lifted would require an act of Congress. And as much as Congress is unable to prevent a restoration of diplomatic ties, Congress very much has a say in whether or not there is actual commerce between the United States and Cuba. Some commerce does go on in accommodation despite this, this economic embargo. The United States sells millions of dollars worth of agricultural goods to Cuba.
There are many Cubans living in the United States who fled the island over the past 50 years. What about traveling back now? Because a lot of families were divided through this time period. And will they be able to have the freedom to go back and forth?
There is a divide among South Florida Cubans, and it's a generational divide. Among the old-timers who fled the island after the revolution, their hatred for Fidel Castro is something that they will carry to their graves. And in fact, many have carried to their graves because as a generation, they're dying out. They're simply getting old. But among the younger Cubans, the sons and daughters of those Cubans and the grandchildren now, and in some cases, the great-grandchildren of these Cubans, there's a sense that that the separation between the United States and Cuba really makes no sense. Why don't we have easier travel? Why can't we visit our relatives back on the island? And there's a real divide on that.
Many in Congress are very opposed to doing anything with Cuba as long as the Castro brothers are still around. Of course, Raul Castro is the current leader of Cuba. Fidel is hanging around. And
he's apparently immortal.
You see him pop up in all kinds of photos and videos. And perhaps he's enjoying his role now as leader emeritus of Cuba.
Indeed. But, you know, this entire debate really boils down to how you view things. Do you view U.S. policy that has existed as a colossal failure in that the Castro brothers have been around and they remain around, and therefore it's time to try something new? Or do you view this as the United States finally giving in and, in essence, coddling a still repressive regime, a regime that restricts the rights and the liberties of its citizens? And there's a real ideological divide on that. It's hard to conceptualize Cuba without a Castro there, but that day is going to come. And it really remains to be seen whether the leadership that follows is going to be reformist or nostalgic.
No, right. Well, it's very difficult for us to conceptualize our program without Michael Bowman. Mike, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Jim.
In Hong Kong, residents marked the 18th anniversary of its return from British to Chinese sovereignty Wednesday with pomp and a protest. July 1st, the annual handover day holiday, is celebrated by city residents loyal to Beijing with raisings of the Chinese flag and other festivities. It's also marked by pro-democracy activists with an annual protest march for greater democracy. That march took place, but the turnout was substantially lower than in previous years, around 20,000, according to independent estimates. Just 2 weeks ago, the pro-democracy political bloc in Hong Kong's Legislative Council succeeded in vetoing the government's Beijing-backed plan for electoral reforms, but the pro-democracy movement has not taken a clear stance on what to do next. Earlier, our weekly TV program #VOA spoke via Skype to two prominent activists on both sides of the political divide in Hong Kong. They include pro-democracy commentator Chip Sow and Lawrence Ma, a spokesman for the pro-Beijing group that calls itself the Silent Majority for Hong Kong. In this clip from the show, host Cal Perry asked them whether Hong Kong's leader will face any further pressure to propose democratic reforms. Sow spoke first.
It will be virtually impossible for the current chief executive, Tsai Ing-wen, to carry out his ruling duties because he's extremely unpopular. His popularity rate has dropped down to less than, to below 30. He's being resented even by the pro-Beijing camps in Hong Kong because they think Tsai Ing-wen is their liability rather than their asset. And now things are simply falling apart. And Tsai Ing-wen could still strongly argue and pretend that nothing has happened and business is going to be usual. However, with this electoral reform package, so-called reform package being voted out, it also signs virtually the death warrant of the effectability and the legitimacy of the current government and the chief executive. So everyone is now locked in this impasse, right? I think we're going to see a few months so-called intermission so that the Democrats would just take a rest. And then, don't forget, the pro-Beijing political camp now is also being shattered because they performed a farce on the voting day by staging a strange and mysterious en masse walkout. And so that what you get on the history book is that the reform package was only supported by 8 votes, right, out of 70. So that was a bit of a joke. And I was told that Beijing gets very, very angry about it. Angry not with the Pan Democrats because their stand has long been expected. Angry with the pro-Beijing political camp and also with CY Leung.
All right, now, I want to give Lawrence Ma a chance to jump in from Hong Kong. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you.
This is not going to happen.
I don't think the political reform package will be reiterated in the coming 2 years. Because the government has correctly so focused the government's effort on livelihood as well as by building flats and having technology innovations for Hong Kong, which is a method of or a way to have a sustainable growth. There will not be another political reform package introduced in this term because of the basic has not changed. The basic is the National People's Congress decision in August, the 31st, that will not be changed. That will not be changed for another 5 to 10 years. So there's no point to talk about political reform at all in this term of government or the next term of government. The government is correct in focusing its effort in people's livelihood issues.
Hong Kong activists Lawrence Ma and Chip Sow, they were speaking to hashtag VOA host Cal Perry. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Mark it on your calendar. This Saturday is Independence Day here in the United States. Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong stopped by to chat with David Byrd about some of the tunes that celebrate America.
This week, the United States celebrates its 239th birthday. Country music is celebrating that with several patriotic hits. But Nikki Strong joins us in the studio. I want to chat about some stuff that people might not have thought of. Now, some of these are pretty obvious, okay? Some of them, like Only in America by Brooks and Dunn.
Yes.
Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning by Alan Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
That's your favorite.
Yes.
Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue by Toby Keith.
That's also a favorite for a lot of folks.
Also American Soldier by
yes.
Toby Keith.
Yes.
But, you know, in thinking about this, there's some songs that maybe people didn't think of.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Aldean, Fly Over States.
Really?
It talks about all these states that people fly over and they, you know, and he talks about trains hauling steel and, you know, corn being grown
yes.
and all that kind of stuff.
What's great about a lot of country music songs is that they do paint pictures of American life.
That's true. And even Kenny Chesney's hit, American Kids,
mm-hmm.
growing
mm-hmm.
up in little pink houses, making
yes.
out in living room couches. I mean, that's
yes.
me in high school,
yeah.
all right? I don't
that's
know about,
a lot of people.
I don't know about the rest of you all, but, you know, my girlfriend's daddy had a shotgun above the door.
Yikes.
So, okay.
We were Jesus, Sammy, blue jean baby, born in the USA. Trailer park, truck stop, faded little map dots, New York to L.A. We were teenage dreaming, front seat leaning, baby, come give me a
There's another one that I thought of, too. The Only Way I Know, mm-hmm. Luke Bryan. That's the only way I know. You know, mm-hmm. Luke Bryan and Jason Aldean and Eric Church. Mm-hmm. Talks about growing up in a small town.
Sure.
So what else we got on the list there?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are tons. A couple of ones that I find to be interesting because they're kind of a little bit off the beaten path. One of them is The Ballad of Ira Hayes, which was a folk song. It's been recorded by a lot of different artists, including Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger. But this version was the most popular, and it was by Johnny Cash. And it tells the story of a Pima Indian that served in the Marine Corps in World War II and was one of the men that raised the flag over Iwo Jima.
Oh, okay.
So, and you see the iconic photograph, yes, and only to return home to his reservation and lose his life to alcoholism.
Brantley Gilbert, one hell of an amen.
Yes.
That's a great song.
Yes, it tells a story.
You know,
yes.
Those are all, you know, they're not really jingoistic, like, you know,
no.
Yay, America, wave the flag.
No.
But they tell an American story.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I think that's part of when you think of country music and celebrating American life in all of its aspects and telling stories. And so my favorite country song of all time, well, not of all time, as far as celebrating July the 4th, is Alan Jackson, Where Were You? When the world stopped turning. He really captures the myriad, the variety of emotions that people experienced in relation to 9/11. And even if you weren't directly impacted by 9/11, if you've ever been impacted by war, this song really moves you.
All right, that's VOA's Nikki Strong. We welcome your comments. You can check us out at VOA_IE on Twitter. Nikki is also on VOA_music
yes.
on Twitter.
Yes.
And you can also catch her on Country Hits USA by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day?
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department prepares detailed reports assessing respect for human rights around the world. The reports, required by law, evaluate how the governments of every country and a number of territories demonstrate respect for human dignity and individual freedoms. Lawmakers, as well as authorities in the executive branch, use the reports to help shape our nation's foreign policies. They also signal to the human rights defenders and activists under siege that our government recognizes their struggle and stands with civil society in its efforts to preserve human rights. For far too many people, 2014 was defined by suffering and abuse perpetrated by terrorist groups exploiting religious discourse and divisions to advance their totalitarian ideology, and by governments like Syria acting repressively in the name of combating terrorism. Meanwhile, governments in China, Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Iran, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, among others, continue to stifle free and open media and the development of civil society through the imprisonment of journalists, bloggers, and nonviolent critics. As in previous years, human rights conditions in Zimbabwe are a particular concern. The most important human rights problems remain the government's targeting for torture, abuse, arrest, and harassment of members of non-ZANU-PF parties and civil society activists. There also continues to be a partisan application of the rule of law by security forces and the judiciary, as well as restrictions on civil liberties. The government took limited steps to punish security sector officials and ZANU-PF supporters who committed violations, but impunity continued to be a problem. The United States has seen its own share of racial discord and unrest in the last year. We approach this report with great self-awareness, but we also understand that when human rights is the issue, every country, including our own, has room to improve. We are committed to the work of advancing universal rights, building the partnerships that will move us forward, helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. In cases of nations such as Zimbabwe, we are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.